Okay, good morning. I'm going to talk about inference of spatial details and protein-protein interactions from multi-species data. As you can see from the title, it's not population genetics, so it's data coming from various species, in this case bacteria. So I will use data from more than 500 different species, but it's a way to infer something about functional aspects in protein-protein interactions from the genetic variability of homologous proteins across across species. So if you look to a protein complex, and okay, let's see, it's a bit like this, two proteins, and then if they interact, they have some very specific interaction surface which has to match pretty well, in the sense that it's not only the geometrical shape which matches, but there is, I don't know, the electrostatic balance and so on has to match in these. And there are a few contacts along the surface, which physical contacts which keep the two proteins together. So it's a very simple picture. And now if you imagine that in this, you make, for instance, a mutation on this protein here, then this most likely has a deleterious effect on the interaction. And to keep this interaction, you might need to compensate for by some interaction on this protein here in the sequence. And in this sense, you introduce some correlations between these two proteins. So you introduce correlations in between the sequences of the of the proteins. And it's exactly these kind of correlations which we want to exploit to get some information about which proteins are in contact along on the surface of some proteins. So I want to use only pure sequence data to get some information from statistical analysis on how these two proteins speak to each other. That's the idea. And I want to use a model system for this, and one system which is very nice for studying this kind of interaction are two-component signal transduction system, TCS. So you may imagine if this is a cell membrane. So I'm talking only about data in bacteria, where this two-component signaling is the standard way of signaling. So you have the membrane, you have a protein which is a has a transmembrane domain, and it's has some kind of receiver for some input signal. Input signals can be various, can be nutrient concentration, pH, temperature, or whatever. So there are various, so this is specific to the input and so is not very conserved among species and among different signaling systems. But then inside the cell, what is happening is highly conserved. So there is a domain which we call SK, sensor kinase domain, and this domain has a residue, a histidine, which if there comes an input, this residue gets phosphorylated. And okay, there's another domain which is an ATPase domain, I don't care about this, which makes the phosphorylation, and then the phosphor gets transferred to another domain, response regulator domain, which has an aspartate here, and which has a second domain. And this, in the most common cases, is a transcription factor. So when you have the phosphor transfer, that should be a P, when you have the phosphor transfer from the signaling kinase, the sensor kinase, to the response regulator, this gets activated and produces some response of the cell. So this is, in a sense, the output. There are systems which work a bit differently. There are systems, for instance, which induce sporulation, which do not work as transcription factors. But the most common system is just built in this way, consists of these two types of proteins. And then if you look, these two domains are very well conserved. So they are believed to be homologous in most signaling system, and that's why this kind of two-component system is a very good candidate for the kind of analysis I'm going to do. So we have this conservation, which means in particular that we can use two hidden Markov models, one for the kinase and one for the response regulator, and scan genomes and produce a lot of examples of these systems. And the conservation also means that there are just there are various hidden Markov models, but the two most prominent hidden Markov models have encounter for about 80% of all two-component systems. So that's very good. Then it is a good system for statistical analysis, also for the reason that it's highly amplified in single genomes. Has something like 10 copies per genome, which is due to the fact that all signaling system, basically all signaling system, work in this way. So for different signals, you have different of these systems. That's why you have more than one per genome. But the systems are very specific in interaction, which means, and if I have an input one, which goes to some kinase one, which transfers a phosphor to a response regulator and makes some output one, and I have a second system which for a second kind of signal, then I don't want to have any crosstalk in general. So there, I don't want to have that the input one induces output, input two induces output one, or input one induces output two. So I don't want to have this. No crosstalk. This is very good, again, for our statistical analysis, because like this, since these systems are in the same species, they have to, and they are, these guys are homologous, these guys are homologous, they have to, they are selected for having anyhow some sequence diversity to achieve specificity.
So they're actually different proteins, or do they just differ by phosphorylation or something?
No, they are different proteins. They're really, so you recognize, for instance, this sequence and this sequence by these hidden Markov models, but there's quite some variability around, I don't know, some.
And there's no example of crosstalk?
No example. There are examples of crosstalk, but in the systems I use, there's very few crosstalk probably. So there are some examples of in vitro crosstalk, but which probably in the competition inside the cell, they just talk to their cognate partners. whereas there are some, for instance, in the Ruthenian sporulation, so-called orphan systems, I will mention these, they have some crosstalk. But the ones, now I would have the problem that if I identify order 10 of kinases, not order 10 response regulators within one genome, who is talking with whom? If I just have the genome and just scan with the hidden Markov model. And there, a very nice thing is that frequently they are organized in operons, means that kinase and response regulators which talk to each other are close in genetic location. So this means I can identify many examples of kinases and response regulators which interact even if I have just the genome information, even if I have no further information on the from the experimental side. And actually, in the systems, the species which were studied more intensively, there you have no. So always, if you have to in one operon, they are an interacting protein system. So there is no exception to this rule, and we extend this rule to all known genomes.
And some examples of what the inputs are. Well, you said there might be 10 of these different things. So what different inputs are you talking about?
Basically, whatever signal, so might be nutrient concentrations, pH, temperature, osmotic pressure. So so the input here is very diverse. And actually, this part is not conserved at all. So this is obviously very specific to the signal you have. So in general, if you have a system which has, I don't know, is living in a very variable environment, then you might have more of these two component systems. So the number actually in the bacteria in different species fluctuates a lot. So it goes from, sometimes we find one or two or zero. We don't find any. And sometimes we find 50 or 70. And in the operons, we find roughly, say, half of the kinases and the half of the response regulators we identify.
Is it known if the protein interactions are conserved across species? So if you take SK1 from one species, it interacts with the regulator of that species. But if you take that same homolog from another species, is that interaction conserved?
I don't know. So in general, so sometimes they are very similar in sequence, but anyhow, you have very closely related systems frequently have, some 20-30% of sequence diversity. And I don't know if this, Actually, I don't know of experiments who try to pair systems from different species. In general, it's believed that they don't talk to each other.
Because if there's compensatory changes going on within each species, then if you mismatch the species, they might not actually work. That would be a prediction of if there's a lot of compensatory changes required for the protein interactions to occur.
I didn't get it. So. Please repeat.
In the model, you have compensatory changes to facilitate this interaction. So if different compensatory changes occur in different species, then if you mix the two components together, then they won't have the same compensatory changes, and so they might not be able to bind anymore.
Yeah, it depends, because it might be that most of these compensatory changes are between different signaling pathways, let's say. So, and that closely related ones are very similar, and sometimes they talk to each other. So I guess you could find some in vitro postulation, but maybe not in vivo. And one thing which is nice about this system is that actually one structure, one co-crystal structure, is known for. So there's.
Nobody sees.
Okay. Which is SPO 0B, which is a sporulation to proteins involved in sporulation in Bacillus subtilis. And so this is the only known co-crystal structure. But this is very nice for us, because if I do some statistical analysis and get some results out of the statistical analysis across species, I have some system to compare with. So I have a structure to compare with. But I don't want to use this structure as an input. I just want to use sequences as an input. Okay, what are the data? I already told you that we use the two-hidden Markov models for the sensor kinase and for the response regulator. Scan genomes, we work with about 550 genomes. And this leads to 6,900 about pairs. SK RR, and these pairs, let's say we have since we align them, since we scan them by hidden Markov models, they are automatically aligned to the hidden Markov model, so automatically we have some kind of global alignment of these which we don't touch, so we believe the alignment to the hidden Markov model. And actually, it looks very good. For instance, it always finds the histidine in the correct place.
Can you just give a rough idea what scanning with the hidden Markov model?
The hidden Markov model is a statistical model for a sequence. And you just go.
You have some consensus sequence, and you look what.
It's a kind of consensus sequence. With some next neighbor, it's like kind of
from your consensus sequence, you sort of score by some kind of a Markov process.
It's this. So it's not exactly a consensus sequence. It's not only like a position weight matrix. So there is also some transition probability from one position to the next. So it's some kind of more like a one-dimensional model. But these are you can. So we didn't design these. We just downloaded from Hammer. It's called. It's a library of hidden Markov models, and you can go over the genomes already in terms express. So the genome in this case is already in terms of proteins. And then you scan all protein sequences, so all amino acid sequences, if they have a good score or not to the hidden Markov model. And then you take out all those which have a good score. For the kinase, you take all the response regulator which have a good score, and then you look if they are adjacent in the genome. I don't know. I guess also since the hidden Markov model is just only for the kinase and only for the response regulator, but probably it's trained on all known kinases which have this kind of structure. So there are several. We use one which is HisKA, which is the most frequent one. And actually, we find in particular for the response regulator, we find more hits which are orphans than others. So I guess it's not only trained on the... So we have this alignment, let's say this is species one. This is the kinase and this is the response regulator. So this is 88 amino acids and this is 124. And then you have the same for other species. And so on.
You have many sequences for each species?
So for each species we have, you can see we have 6,900 sequences in 500, so it's 12 or so on average for each species.
And the pairing from left to right is just arbitrary or?
The pairing from left to right is the operon. So I scan with the hidden Markov model and have a big library of, for each species, I have some, say, 20 kinases.
And which species are those? Also like eukaryotes and?
No, just bacteria.
Just bacteria, okay.
Yeah, all bacterial genomes we can find. So we used all bacterial genomes which were on the RefSeq database.
And they always are on the same operon, these?
No, they are not always on the same operon. So roughly half of the kinases are found on an operon with a response regulator. And I include only these into the into my data set. So in fact, the others are a problem. And the others are a computational problem, which we are working on now. So to predict who is interacting with whom, if they are so-called orphans, so they are lonely somewhere in the genome, they don't have their partner.
I missed that. Okay, thank you.
So here I have 550, say. These all together are 7,900. So it's a huge number of sequences. And what I told you, I want to detect correlations between the two proteins, between positions. So I want to take one column in here, call this I, one column in the other one, J, and I want to say something about statistical correlations between these two, and in how far then these statistical correlations are actually related to the fact that these two are in spatial vicinity in here. So you have roughly 10 to the 4 of these pairs, because it's basically 100 times 100 amino acid or position pairs. And in this interaction surface, you would expect something like order of 10 pairs which are actually in contact. So you want to find this 1% of interacting pairs or of physically interacting pairs. So in this, gives us sequences A1, 1, 2, A1, N, where N is just the sum of these two. So I just put them together in one sequence, and so AI1, AI, AN, with A running from 1 to M, which is this 6,900. So that's my notation. And out of this data, I want to get some statistical information. So the easiest thing I can do is to calculate frequencies, how frequently I find some amino acid in a specific position, and how frequently I find a pair of amino acids in two positions. So I just introduce frequency counts Fi of Ai. So which counts how frequently this amino acid AI is found in one of these positions, and I can do the same Fij of AI AJ for pairs. So how frequently I find a pair AI, AJ in positions I and J. Okay, and that's a quantity which I still can estimate very nicely from the data I have here, because that's 21 times 21, because I have 20 possibilities for the amino acids. In the alignment I have gaps, which I just count as some kind of 21st letter. So this is 21 by 21, and here I have 6,900 pairs. So on average, I see each of these elements more than 10 times. So that's already a pretty good statistics. Whereas if I would go to triplets, I would have a problem, because I would have more entries in this matrix than I have.
IJ index goes over location?
IJ are the locations here. This is column I and this is column J.
Is there a problem?
Whereas the A is going over sequences.
Does it matter that all of the observations are not independent of one another?
Yes, that's that's a big open question. All the approach I use here is basically assuming that they are independent.
Is this realistic? And isn't that the whole problem of this analysis, is to figure out how much of, you're going to start looking for correlations.
Yes.
And the question is, how much of correlation that you see is just a common descent, or worse, just oversampling, right?
Yes. That's, let's say, the results in a certain sense show that this is working pretty well. That's a problem in all statistical analysis. We have tried something where we have said, okay, we want to compensate a bit for a bias of oversampling of certain regions. And so we have, instead of just counting these frequencies, we have introduced an individual reweighting for every sequence. So for every example, and for this reweighting, we have counted how many sequences there are which have at least 80 or 70% or so sequence identity, and have used this as a reweighting. So if you have 10 times the same sequence, you have a reweighting factor 1 over 10 for all of these, and you count once at the end. And this doesn't change at all the final result. So we have tried a bit, but the question in how far I can use something phylogenetical here is an open, interesting question. Yeah.
But it's also not an unstudied question to some extent, right? Because everybody encounters the same problem, and the same problem comes up in all sorts of other instances. So do you have an idea what sort of the state of the art
Yes. Yeah. A problem is that in there are some problems. One problem is that already there is no good reconstruction of a phylogenetic tree for this, because frequently the sequences inside the inside one species are much more distant than similar signaling system in between species. So that's a bit a problem.
For example, Ramaranganathan and friends, study some very similar problem. In fact, pretty much identical problem with different set of
So they use
proteins, and they also do something or other to confront the same problem. And
they average over the proteins. What they do is at each locus, they say, let's take an average over all possible amino acids, and then they make a single matrix which they find principal components of. And that gives them kind of co-evolving structures within you. But he's trying to do something more subtle, right? Which is that within a species, where are the sites that are which compensate for each other?
Right, but they use also a lot of
Right. It's just that he's looking at pairs, whereas Rama and friends would just be looking at two different residues in the same gene. But to the extent that his data set is exactly, it's an identical problem.
It's similar, very similar.
It's a very similar, yeah.
With principal components?
Oh, what they do is they average over all of these. Instead of the AI AJ, they average over all the AI AJs, assuming that the evolutionary time across these species is more than 100 million years. Because they take serine proteases, the first analysis that Rama did. And then they do they find a single matrix, Fij, which they diagonalize. And they find
IJ.
That Fij that he's written over there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you average over all the amino acids, you get a single matrix. Right? Which is
so they start with
function.
Yeah.
Right? Which is the point correlation function over all of evolutionary time in this protein. And then they
but it's still averaged over all the genomes, right?
Yeah, it's averaged over all the genomes. But principal components doesn't care about sampling bias. You just get more, because if you have many, you'll get lots of points in a cluster which correspond to each species. And what they really care about is what are the co-evolving loci on this protein across species. And that you can find. Right? The principal components will find you the I and the J that are correlated. And they find that there are multiple structures evolving independently in the protein, which are functional. Mm-hmm. So I have a question about that. Do you know what the generation time across these species is? How is it, thousands of is it millions of years? Is it?
I don't know.
Well, I think they come from all over the tree.
Yeah.
So they must be very, very old, right? It must be huge.
Yeah. So probably they were, basically from the very beginning.
Right. So for every locus in which there is a change in amino acid, you should probably see all possible amino acids, right? All possible substitutions.
Yeah, you don't see all of them, but you say a huge number. So that some obviously are completely conserved, like the histidine here, which is absolutely functional, and which obviously you cannot find with any correlation analysis because it's just fixed. But for instance, the places which show considerable correlation have something like an entropy, which is a logarithm of 10, 15 or so. So the effective number, if they would be equally distributed, would be 10 or 15. So the real number obviously is a bit higher.
Does that look like you find some in the species
almost identical to the other species? Are you saying that this is also transferred?
You find a lot of
different
species. That's why you cannot
be bound to these? No, I would say that just the maybe they go back to some duplication, but the duplication events inside a species happened before species divided. So you had already many two-component systems, and then you see somehow the
but isn't the philosophy just approach simply that you don't care about all that you just want to identify correlations that are still there, and you don't have to worry where they came from?
But you can build up artificial correlation just from bed sampling.
Yes, but that's made by variance measures, right? So at least some sort of order of magnitude estimates of whether you have sampling bias, just by looking at the variability of the frequency of the given site, just by looking at the entropy, right? You have some estimate for what your entropy should be.
Okay, anyhow, what the method does is just assuming that they are independent. And okay, from this I can, the simplest thing I could calculate would be just the mutual information as a measure of correlation between two columns, which would be Mij is just which, as you all know, is zero if and only if this Fij is factorized. So this is a measure of whatever correlation is in there between I and j, also beyond linear correlation. And you can draw a histogram of this mutual information, so we can calculate about 10,000 pairs of mutual information and can just a histogram the log of the number of times you have some certain mutual information over the mutual information, and you find something that this looks a bit like this. So there's some exponential background, and then at a certain point there is some small signal which is possibly above this exponential background. So you can look as a first guess to these guys which have something more than this exponential background, and these are about 30 pairs of positions in between the kinase and the response regulator. And if you look to this co-crystal structure, about 10 of them are in spatial vicinity in this co-crystal structure. So about 10 of them are actually physically in physical contact in so that's only 1/3 out of these, which is possibly not so bad because we are starting with 10,000 of 10,000 pairs, but which is not necessarily satisfying. And one important point is that this is just measuring any correlation between I and J, and is not giving any information where this correlation might come from. So the mutual information itself is not able to say us if we are in a situation, for instance, where we have these pairs I and J and we have a strong link in between them, or if we have a situation IJ where they interact indirectly, even, I don't know, like this. And both situations, even if there is no direct interaction, both situations might induce a similar mutual information. And mutual information on its own, since it looks just to two positions, is not able to distinguish between these two.
Is it fair to say, like, if you're talking about relatively small numbers, that it's probably quite sensitive to the choice of the null model Fi? I mean, that variations in that would decide whether this, or how robust is this?
This is pretty robust in various senses. So if you take just 1,000 pairs, you basically find the same ones which are up there. If you take a slightly stupid null model which permutes or inside species or all the response regulators to destroy correlation, to just account for finite size effect, that's something which is much smaller. So that this kind of null model would go down here. So this there's something which is beyond finite size effects, for instance. But then obviously if you would have some better, I don't know, evolutionary model or so, there might be. But that's the kind of null model we tested. And there, all these 30 there are pretty robust. So not only the ones which are in physical contact.
So I thought that this picture that you drew with a bumpy tail is basically a statement that your typical behavior there is noise, right? And you're looking for sort of the outliers. And then, of course, the question is, you're sort of far in the pale, which means that you only have few samples, right? And then there's a little bit of question of, you know, significance of, you know, like, typically, if you look at the data, that tail won't quite look as pretty as in this picture because it will be undersampled and there'll be a lot of noise, right?
Why do you mean it's that, but that's not, the tail is pairs in here, and it's so it's not a random sampling of a tail. So that's just, and I know that there are just very few pairs in contact. So I know that I need some tail which has only few, because I want to get order 10 contact pairs out of 10,000 pairs.
I understand that, but you know, there's sort of problems with you know, difficulties with that, right? So roughly speaking, you're testing lots of pairs, so there are lots of hypotheses, right? So you have to sort of correct for your multiple hypothesis testing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to get the significance out of very many tests, right? So suppose we were just doing random pairs, right? And you were just looking for, you know, correlations that arise there by chance in the sampling, right? But you're testing very many.
What do you mean as random pairs? So the statistics is over these 6,900.
Maybe.
So I
think I'll ask you in private.
And here I'm exhaustive over all pairs. So,
did you ever try to think of MIJ as a distance metric and try to do hierarchical clustering on this matrix to find out if there are groups of sites that seem to co-evolve? Because you could find, if you did principal component analysis of MIJ, think of it as just a matrix, and you diagonalize this matrix, you'll find groups of sites which are co-evolving. And that might give you this tail of the spectrum directly. The rest of them are random, and then, as Boris says, few of them are important, and then you could do then some kind of an analysis to test whether this is significant or not.
No, that's...
No, it's not, but you can think of this. Okay.
Yeah. So,
well, in fact, there's another thing which is closely related to this. I think it's the Jensen, which has properties of distance.
Yeah, okay. Change the definition so that it has some of the properties of a distance, and then.
But in fact, there's another quantity which is closely related to this, which is distance. So you might maybe use that.
Yeah. Even for clustering, you don't need necessarily distance.
It's
so.
But it's just simpler.
So, are your I and J definitely in different proteins?
Yes.
Here, in this case, they are definitely in different proteins.
But you could do the same thing in the same protein.
Yes.
So I'd be interested to know how big your tail is for the sites in one protein relative to the sites in two different proteins.
They are relatively comparable. So the highest in between the proteins are in between the highest also if I take all the pairs, also in intra-protein pairs. Even if they, I don't know how many, but the first are inside the protein. But still you find some similar tail, but that's, I don't know, I'm looking, if I make the statistics of all, I'm looking over different signals. So I there is no reason why a signal between two columns here should be comparable to two columns in between the proteins.
I'm just trying to understand the strength of coevolution between two proteins relative to the strength of coevolution between two sites in the same protein, which are important for the structure of that one protein.
But I will come back at the end because to this point, because these response regulators form, in their active form, they form homodimers. And there we have looked to the response regulator against itself. And there we see that some of the highly correlated pairs are inside the structure, or they are in close contact in the monomer, and some are giving the dimer, and they are comparable. But I'll come back to this.
Sorry, going back to the distribution, but I guess the very important thing that you said was that, if I understand correctly, if you permute your two-component systems, right?
Yeah, if you permute the response regulators.
Then you actually find a much narrower distribution.
Yes.
Which is basically saying that it isn't just the outliers which are significant.
Yes.
But really everything is significant.
Yes. Yes.
So what's the meaning of the exponential background in this sense?
It's one of the let's say the idea I have, which is very much a statistical physics type idea, is that there is actually some network of direct interactions, and for instance second, third or so neighbors show some correlation but lower correlation. And this can even if you have just a few contacts, you can generate such a tail.
But that doesn't have to be, right? The protein has a structure which is very different from its sequence. And so distant amino acids could be close and be functionally related, even though they may not show up in the sequence. So you could find subtle correlations. They're all buried in your matrix, but to look for them, you can't just take nearest neighbors.
Well, but she doesn't.
Right. So that's why there is information in every part of that curve, not just in...
Yeah.
But in view of this, going back to that little bump at the end, I really don't understand why focus on that bump. So usually when one does it, because there is no difference between your correct and permuted order, except for the outliers, right? So if you permute, very often you'll find the same distribution, which will just continue as exponential forever, right? And that's sort of what you subtract, and that's why you look at the bump.
Yeah.
But given that...
okay, there here...
So different, why take that bump? You know, you can just decide to look at 50 pairs or 100 pairs.
Yeah, okay.
Or 10 pairs.
You can do two things. Or you say, okay, there is some background which I don't understand. I have no model for the background, but I see that there's some signal which is still above this background. And I look to this, and I still don't understand the background.
What is the background? Is the background the continuation of that wide exponential, or is the background the narrow exponential?
What I say here, background is this one. So there is this looks as if there would be two distributions. Both of, I don't understand neither of them, but I try to concentrate possibly to these. Another thing you could do, you say just, okay, I don't care about this at all, and use my mutual information as a kind of ranking, and say, okay, I just go down here, start with the highest one, and then I find the highest one, okay, is a contact pair, the second one is not, the third one is not, the fourth one is, and so on.
Yeah, but I guess what...
But actually, I don't like this plot very much. So, if you give me the possibility to go on...
I guess what Boris is saying that you may be much too conservative with your null model.
Sorry?
I guess what Boris is saying that you may be much too conservative with your null model, because you're putting things in the denominator that may well be part of the numerator.
Martin, but wouldn't the right null model be that you just take the right frequencies and you then just draw new ensembles without any correlations?
Yeah, but that's exactly what I do if I permute randomly here. because I conserve all the columns in a sense. I permute just the response regulators, just the order of these.
Yes.
So that I have exactly the same sequences. So that and I just destroy any correlation between these two proteins.
And that curve is the one that has only the...
And this is the one which goes down at the much smaller values.
Exponential also?
More than, faster than exponential. Okay, then. Still, in any case, the argument which holds is that if I have this mutual information here, it doesn't tell me anything about direct or indirect interactions.
If you were to generate data with, imagine that the exponential is the background. I don't understand the background, but let's assume that I have this exponential. Mm. Can I generate data assuming this exponent, this correlation exponentially correlated, and generate data and see if the bump is just undersampled? So can I make a new model where I assume this exponential? I don't understand, but I just take the exponential. And then I create an amount of data like this to see if that's undersampled or not.
How do you want to do this?
But you haven't tried this. I mean, this is not the same.
So something we have tried, which is very simple, is just if you take a model just over something like a random graph or so, and generate, you find structures like this, where here you have mostly the interacting, the directly connected pairs. And these are actually correlations which arise as second and third neighbors. So what I said before, we have tested in some simulations, but obviously that has nothing to do with this data.
And this curve here that falls off, you said it's Gaussian, for example?
Or? Yeah, mutual information is not exactly Gaussian, but... but it looks, it goes down faster than exponential. Okay, what I want to do is to distinguish what could be direct and indirect correlation. So I want to do some kind of global inference. And I want to have some model which gives me a joint probability of all the sequence. And in this probability should obviously I cannot do this just by counting, because I told you that already for three I cannot do by counting. So, but what I can ask is, okay, I want to have some global model which is coherent with data at least at the level of the single site and the pair frequencies. So I can ask that this has some, that the sum over all A, K, so if I calculate a single site distribution, then this has to be equal to Fi of Ai. And the same if I have here k different ij, so I have a pij of Ai aj. Uh, asking anything behind this pair correlation doesn't make any sense because my empirical distributions wouldn't be reasonably sampled anymore. And beyond this, I use maximum entropy, which says that I want the entropy of this distribution to be maximized under these constraints. And this leads me immediately to a formulation in terms of a Hamiltonian or a model which consists of pair interactions and local field. So this immediately gives me that this P1, PA1 to AN is proportional to some exponential minus sum over I over all pairs, some pair interaction. Where I have to find these parameters to fulfill these constraints. So that's, in a sense, the least constrained model I can find, which is consistent with my empirical distribution.
That's a path integral with those as the representations of the path integral, right? Those examples as representations of your path integral formulation. Right, isn't that just a partition function?
Never seen it like this.
The PA, A1 through AN is a partition function.
Yeah. Right? So this is a kind of Boltzmann distribution. So I could add a 1 over.
Okay.
Which would be the sum over all.
You can within Markov models to locate the sequences, and there is some probability of each protein aligning with its in Markov model, right? So that is already a P, isn't it? The P that comes from the hidden Markov model is a good model for the P, isn't it?
No, it is not, because it doesn't care about these long-range correlations, which I want to detect. And in particular, the hidden Markov models are two distinct models for these two. So this would be exactly factorized in between the two. Whatever model I have for the kinases and for the response regulators would be factorized. And that's really what I don't want to have, because I want to describe the correlations between the two sequences, which come out of these selected sets where I know that they interact.
Yeah, so can you build some kind of a joint model and use the hidden Markov model as the null to compare that thing with?
Okay, I didn't compare to the hidden Markov model. I compared, since I have no explicit form of the hidden Markov model available, so I compared to a model which is basically like a position-weight matrix, so which would be a product of all these. So the mean field version of this model.
But this formulation, if you were to, there's nothing stopping you from including more pairs than 30 that you extracted from the
data. Yes, actually I do.
There's something preventing you?
No. I include more pairs. I include as many as possible of these, and there, for computational reasons, I'm restricted to less than 70 here. But I use the what I use is actually I go down this sequence. and take all the so I go up to here or so. And I include I told you that I don't like this plot. No, but and here in this I have all I have also interactions inside the single domains. So this is not a sum only over pairs in between domains. So it's also inside domains, which is important because I could have I don't know that these guys are inside the same domain and this is in the other domain, and but the information, yeah, the mutual information comes also via this correlation. So I include also all the pairs inside in this kind of inference. And actually if I do this inference with 30 positions or 50 positions or 70 positions, the not these, but the the ones which are relevant, which are either high mutual information or also the high strong direct interaction here, are robust with respect to this. Okay, obviously the point is this is something like a 21 state POTS model, and I have to fitted to this data, which is a computationally non-trivial task. And so what we have used is some kind of iterative procedure. So we have to fit the model.
You've introduced effectively a temperature into this, right? By writing this as a Boltzmann functional? So don't you want the zero temperature limit of that?
No, because I want to have all the fluctuations which are in here. So I'm not interested in the most likely pair of a kinase and the response regulator in all over the world. I want to this. So it's in a sense, something which is more in the sense of a high temperature.
So you're trying to estimate the EIJs and the
EIJs.
So that it's what, at any temperature it will have?
No, I don't have temperature. So my variables, if I would go to a real statistical physics model, my degrees of freedoms would be the interaction energy divided by KBT. So I can't distinguish between the two. So, but yeah, since it's a statistical model, this temperature doesn't make much sense. Okay, in the iterative procedure, I start with some test Hamiltonian. And just for this test Hamiltonian, I have to estimate these guys. And that's a computationally difficult problem, because that is basically like calculating a partition function and for an arbitrary system. So that's something we don't know to do. And so the exact definition would be exponential, would be something like 21 to the number of positions I have here, which is I went to 70, so 20 to 70 is not doable. And you can do, this has to be done with approximate method. So you could make Monte Carlo Markov chain, or you could make message passing.
Couldn't you do this directly in, not in a canonical ensemble, but in a microcanonical ensemble where the temperature is a derived quantity? You actually, you can fix the energy. And you can derive the temperature
but
as a function of the energy.
Yeah, you don't know the energy.
The energy is the expectation value. Your energy function is...
And you are basically at high temperature, so there will be fluctuation.
No, that's fine. I'm not doubting that. But you're saying that you want to estimate... You know what the average energy is, because your Fi and Fi are basically two-point functions and one-point function. and you want to derive the temperatures that give you that, and the standard formalism of...
Yeah, I don't want... It's just only the... Not only the temperature, it's a full EIJ. And...
So you mean I
could fix this and
But there's a way to introduce what Boltzmann did, which is daemons. You introduce small variables that can change the two-point function and the one-point function, and then the fluctuations in that daemon variable will give you the temperatures. We can talk about it afterwards. Mm. There is a whole formalism of field theory where you can derive it backwards.
Which you can do if even if the system is translationally completely non-invariant and so in the...
Basically, all you're doing is those two constraints are delta function constraints in your partition function. And you want to find the temperatures which solve those constraints. And there's a way to do it backwards, which will do that. It's like asking, what's the temperature at which the energy of the system, energy per unit volume, is something. And there is a way to do that backwards.
Okay. So what I did was is message passing, which is a way of approximate inference, so of approximate calculation of these guys from something like this. Actually, this is a variant which was developed by Mark and his former PhD student, Thierry Morat.
But you know there's no unique solution to this?
There's no unique solution.
Well, there is a unique. There is a unique because that's a convex.
But there's a unique decomposition into single and two-body terms?
No, that's not unique, yeah. So there is some null mode in this and you should fix somehow. So I chose to fix some kind of a gauge which removes completely this. So for instance, if you look to an Ising model, I would describe an interaction here with a 2x2 matrix, and I need just one parameter. So I can do, but this is in the model I actually use, which has some kind of gauge fixing conditions. There is no the solution is unique.
So I'm just asking about your method. Does it also fix gauges?
No, I'm saying something very simple. When you go from the microcanonical ensemble to the canonical ensemble, what do? You have a system at a fixed energy, and you want to then want to infer what the temperature is. And how do you do that? You put a thermometer in there. So you can do the same thing here. This is a system where he wants to fix the energy, the total energy, which is his Fij. And you can imagine a thermometer variable that goes in there, and you go over all possible states which allow you to keep the energy constant. With this thermometer, which is allowed to exchange energy, and the fluctuation of the thermometer tell you what the parameter is. So there is.
But you have to do this exhaustively, going over all the states, or
you can do this in a simulation, just like you did before, except that the simulation works forward rather than. See, you have to go backwards to infer things. You have to infer the temperature for each realization, whereas here you can do it the other way. You can change the energy. You can fix the total energy is some number, and then you allow it to fluctuate.
And you can do also with fixing a large number of constraints.
Yes. Yeah. You can put as many delta function constraints you want.
It's not 2. It's much more than 2.
You can fix any number of delta functions. You sum over all states.
Right, but then I need to explore my
model. Sounds like you have a project for the rest of the afternoon.
We can talk about it afterwards. Mm. Okay. Maybe it's not possible. There's a standard formalism that you can try.
Okay, I did in my approach. I had to solve the direct problem, so calculating these out of this for many times, because then I have some iterative update, which is of the type. That I say, okay, the delta in some coupling EIJ, AIJ. Is some small prefactor times the Pij of AI AJ minus FIJ AI AJ, which, okay, yeah, this should be the correct sign. So that, which means that if I have some, I see them more frequently than I would see them, I increase this E by something, but because of this negative sign, I would decrease the effect. And doing this several times, I get more and more precise. And if I reach some precision, I stop. And find some parameters of the EIJ and the HI, which lead to a model which has pair interactions and which has these correct marginal distributions. And from this, I would like to have something which is like mutual information, or so I have now for every pair of positions. So for every of these two columns I have here, I would have a 21 by 21 matrix. And I would like to have some kind of scalar parameter. And there, and there is a way which I would like to. So if I how do I construct this? If I want to characterize the total correlation of the system, in a sense, I can take the Kalba-Leibler divergence of this from something which would be a product over independent sites. So if I so this characterizes, in a sense, the total correlation I have in the system. And the best way would be if I could write this as something which is a sum over I smaller j, some contribution coming from each link. So that would be something in a canonical way. This would give a measure of the contribution of a single link. And actually, I can do this not exactly, but approximately in the using the beta approximation. And this DIG is just is a kind of is some modified mutual information. I write down and explain later. Where I have to define some direct interaction, some direct contribution to the interaction between two positions, and this comes just from a system where I take I where isolate I and j from the total system, make them to interact by this interaction eij which I inferred before, and ask them to have the correct fi and fj of AJ. So in this way, in a sense, I eliminate whatever indirect interaction from the system. I just count the direct interaction. And the joint distribution of these two is this one. So this is something which, since I have just two variables, I can calculate easily. And then I have this expression, which we call direct information. Which gives the contribution of a single link to the total correlation of the system. And I don't know, maybe shall we make a short break and I come to the results after? Just to run and remind you, we had these two measures. One is okay behind there, which was the direct information, which gave us some idea of how much of correlation might be really due to a single link between two I and J, so due to this interaction here. And we had the mutual information in the beginning, which we discussed quite a lot. Which tells you what is the total correlation between a pair. So also due to indirect things. So I can just make a plot one against the other. And in this plot, basically the bump was everything which was behind here in the mutual information. So this is mutual information. And this is direct information. And you see that the ones which have somehow high mutual information go over the full range. I think there was a pointer in here. The ones which have this high mutual information go over the full range of direct informations. So there are some which are up here in this red part, which have also a high direct information. So I would say they are strongly linked directly, and others which have just some very low values of this direct information. Still, they have high mutual information. So I see that there is some correlation, but I see that this correlation is due to basically due to indirect effects. And okay, if I take these are the 32 links which had a high mutual information, and I say okay, I color red those which have a relatively high direct information, and green those which have a relatively low direct information, and I just plot this graph here, and here I don't know if it is very well visible. So you have I have plotted this kind of network on top of the of actual protein structures. So this is a kinase, so which is a two helix. So there's one helix, a loop, and it goes back, and it comes as a homodimer, so as a four helix bundle. So, but this is, and here the yellow one is the active residue, so the histidine. And this is the response regulator. And you see that all the ones which have a high direct information, they are on the side of the kinase, they are here in this region on top of the two helices, and here they are all on one helix. And you can really imagine that this goes in there. So you can bring all of these guys close together spatially. And you see that actually many of these links are isolated. So this is isolated, this is isolated, and sometimes this is not very connected, whereas all this part here is extremely connected. 14 has, okay, this one is, yeah. So, yeah. But they are actually all in contact at the end. So it's really, so the neighbors are, this 14 has this one, has this one, and this one, and they are on the two helices. So you may imagine that you have these two helices and the other is going really into it, and so makes contact, this helix makes contact to both of the helices. But if you bring these together, all these green dyes would be far away from each other, or most of them would be far away from each other. And we see that there seems to be a pretty clear correlation between what is the value of this direct information compared to what might be an interaction mode of these two. And here you see that basically everybody is connected to everybody in this green part. So in total, it's much more connected. And okay, I told you that there is one co-crystal structure, which is this SPO0F, SPO0B. And which is a co-crystal structure, which is has been a bit under discussion, because the kinase, which is this one here, here you see better the two helices, is a bit atypical, because the angle between these two helices is different from the typical kinases. And actually, this is also this doesn't so the first this. Alpha 1 helix here aligns very well to the hidden Markov model, whereas the other does not align very well to the hidden Markov model. So it's not, and there's quite some discussion if this is representing the correct picture for a typical kinase and a typical response regulator, but it's the only co-crystal structure we have. So, and in this co-crystal structure, we can actually measure distances, and the ones I have I've displayed here as a surface are actually the ones which were the red positions, the red residues before, and this looks here pretty nicely. So they fit together. And okay, and in this I can calculate the separation of the atoms in the residues, and I can plot this against mutual information or direct information. And now in principle I can say I start with take them as a ranking, and I start with the highest one. So for instance, the blue ones are mutual information. The highest one here has a distance of 4 angstrom or so. I would say, okay, that's a contact pair. So in this plot here, I go one right. I the first one I found and is a good one. Then the next one is this one here. So they are pretty distant. They are at 13 or 14 angstrom. So this is not the contact pair. And I go down here. The third one is not the contact pair. I go down here. Then I find probably this one, which is a contact pair, and so on. So the specificity counts the fraction of actual contact pairs in between the ones I found in this ranking, just starting from the highest. And here you see that there is this about one third, which I told you before. So this would be the everything which is on the left of this point would be the bump. But the curve here also goes on. And if I do the same game for the mutual information, I find the first one is okay, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, and so on. And I predict the first 10 pairs before making the first error. And in all the structure, there are only 19 pairs which are actually in spatial contact. So more than half of them are the ones which are the highest ranking direct information things. And obviously I cannot say that I cannot aim at finding all of them, because I characterized by some some correlation between them. And for instance, the pair, the absolutely conserved histidine and aspartate, which make the phosphotransfer, I will never find them in this, but they have to be in spatial contact to make the phosphotransfer. So obviously I can find only a subset just by the method I use. And a completely random thing would be down here. Yeah.
So is this only pairs across proteins, or also?
This is only across proteins.
So it's what it looks like within proteins?
Yes. Yes. This is only across proteins. And okay, I had this plot, and in this plot I had the red ones and the green ones, and I had here this blue cloud, which I didn't discuss, which is a bit unclear, because they have maybe relatively high direct information but low mutant information, or yeah, so they are a bit some kind of shadow region. And okay, this plot is basically like the one I showed you before, but presented in a bit different way. So I have the position on the kinase and on the response regulator. And I just, the black ones are the ones which are at most at 6 angstrom difference, so which I would say are contact pairs. Then gray is 12, and this is larger than 12. And you see the red ones are the pairs I showed you before, so they are all in contact. The blue ones are in contact, or also here there's would be one false positive, and whereas the ones which have high mutual information but low direct information are almost all relatively distant. Up to, for instance, this one, but this is very close to the active residue, and this might be accidental that they are close, or it's just not shown by this kind of correlation. Okay, there was the question of what happens within a single protein, and I told you that the response regulator, at least those which are transcription factors, homodimerize in their active form and become DNA binding in as a homodimer. And we have selected out of all response regulators all those which have known DNA binding domain, so which is a subset still comparably large. And have made the same analysis just for the sequence of the response regulator. And there, obviously, we have, in a sense, a problem, because if we have the if we have a homodimer, we may see correlations which are due to which are inside one domain. So which may, for instance, characterize contact pairs inside the structure, which may be far in sequence, but in the folded state they are close, and others which are in between, which make actually the interaction in the homodimer. And the astonishing thing is that the majority is we find in between the ones which have high direct information is in between the pairs. And sorry, opposite. It's inside the protein. So here you have the 12 highest ranking, and there are, but the first one and the third one, for instance, they are, here this is the monomer, they are far in the monomer. You see the distance is 17 angstrom. Whereas if you look to the dimer, they are at 3.6 angstrom, so they are in contact. So they are drawn two times, because obviously there are two of these pairs, whereas the second is a contact pair inside, the third one is again in the dimer. And already these two, if you look, these are here, so they basically define you how the dimer is done. And we find in between the high ranking DI, if we find for inter-protein contact pairs and something like 40, 50 intra-protein contact pairs.
Do you also pick up these helix periodicities or sort of antisense helices that
you pick?
Are they obvious in the data?
You pick up very few of them, astonishingly few. So here, maybe these are. Oh, wait a moment. I don't know if there's an example. No, this is already taken out. So in between the first 12, there were some which were just at distance 3 in the sequence, and which were one turn of the helix away from each other. But they were relatively few.
What's the how many amino acids are in one?
It's 3 point something. So it's between 3 and 4. And actually, if you go back, no, this was arm. If you look here, you see this periodicity. So you see here it's 75, 72, and 71, 68, and 67. So you see this periodicity of 3, 4. Because all these are exposed, so they are on the same side of the helix. Yeah, that's...
I was going to say that if you're looking at a dimer like this, then the thing functions as a dimer, and so there's really no difference between interactions between the two strands and within one strand, because the thing is functioning as a dimer anyway, right? So you could just step back and say there's a simpler problem, which is to look at proteins that don't have dimers, and to look at predicting the important interactions within one protein.
So that's more in the Ranganathan idea.
You could say this is a framework for doing protein structure prediction.
Yeah.
Or maybe...
So this might something which informs, let's say, structure prediction, because predicts long distance pairs.
So
the point is that you need a lot of homologous sequences. So we made from this data we made some estimates. So if you are down to 1,000, you still have a good signal. If you go to 500 or so, which would be for a current bacteria data set, one per genome, don't see so much. Which is so the probably maybe you can do something that you coarse grain, or I don't know, you define amino acid classes, so to improve somehow statistics, but with this approach which takes every amino acid as some different object, and so you are at the limit, you start to see things if you have at least 1,000 sequences. Okay, and just as an outlook, there is one statistical physics part, which is this inference part, and this is something which we have also discussed with Mark. And so there is a problem of how to reconstruct a model from microscopic configurations. This is basically what I tried here, but I, for instance, I fitted all these even if they are not extremely well sampled. So maybe I can do some kind of looser fitting, which allows for errors here, but which puts some of these matrices exactly to zero. So which somehow gives puts down my background of small, but probably just noise fitting direct informations. And in biology, there is a question of the phylogenetic bias, which we discussed a bit before. And then one of the interesting question is, I told you that all the data set I analyzed was from this operon data, so where I had the kinase and the response regulator in an operon. And roughly half of the kinases and much less, so only a third or a fourth of the response regulators, which we find with the hidden Markov models, are actually in operons. So a lot are just isolated in the genome. And it would be interesting to see how they interact. For instance, this SPO0F, SPO0B system is an orphan system. It's not. Okay, and then it's a question if this can inform some more structural approaches, which and how far we can go to protein sieve systems which have just one copy per genome. There, for instance, if one would use some kind of metagenomic data, one might increase the data quantity. Okay, thank you.
So you distinguish between sites which have one-to-one correlations and sites which have one-to-many correlations, right? In your picture where you had all these green and red lines. And so you can think of the ones that have one-to-one correlations as forming pairs, and possibly the other ones, and one interpretation would be that they change the conformation, there's more global conformation of the proteins, right? Now, you could you check that by comparing the data for two proteins, the within proteins data, because you would expect the green ones that have many contacts would also correlate strongly with the other guys in the same protein, whereas the one-to-one contact wouldn't correlate as much. Does that make sense? Maybe we can talk about it later. But
so maybe now what could happen is that you can, but I show only the ones in between the proteins, not the links which are inside the proteins in the slot. But that these two, for instance, behave pretty independently, so that basically in this model I can factorize out these. And this should be, in a sense, detectable.
Right.
But I'm not sure if this is true. I should look more, because there are other strong interactions inside the proteins, which I don't display in this plot because it's nice, because I just projected to all inter-domain pairs.
So can you use the direct or the neutral information to predict the two components?
So you find these interactions, and like you insert it's all of the data is from the cases where they're in the same operon, so you know that they are interacting with each other. But a lot of cases, you don't know if they're interacting. So if you can actually predict which components are interacting with each other, that would be quite useful.
That's one of the things we're working on. So that's, it's okay if you take, for instance, half of the cases of the in the operons and predict the other one, you predict 95% of the others correctly. But the orphans might behave a bit differently, so it might have some different evolutionary history, and so there you, that's something we are working on. I forgot to go to the last slide.
95% correct, is that due to the direct information or the mutual information?
So what we do there is something which is so if you look, the mutual information is not bad, but the direct information is better. So it goes from 90 to 95% in this case, basically, or from 88 to 95. So summing in a sense the contributions to the direct information coming from a single sequence over all inter-domain pairs is the best way we find for if we take half of the operon pairs and predict the others. And for the orphans, it's a bit more complicated to say if we are predicting something useful or not. So we can look to well-studied systems, but these guys should have some programs running in this moment to hopefully produce this output. But it's we have no output yet. He tries to.
Is there a way to incorporate sort of what we know about the chemical properties of these amino acids into the inference? Like, for example, I might expect that would give you some prior expectation for the direct interaction terms. Say hydrophobic residues interacted more or something like that.
I don't know if there is an a priori way. So something which might be interesting is if you look to these, if they are somehow correlated to, if you see that this looks like a hydrophobic interaction, or if this looks like electrostatic.
I think part of this is, so what people have been doing for a very long time is just using these biochemical variables like hydrophobicity and making them the reaction coordinate, and then doing PCA on using that reaction coordinate, and that introduces huge bias and then isn't very effective. So this is sort of trying to get away from that.
So if you look actually to pairs which are predicted to interact and which really interact and how they interact, then you'll find that in different proteins they interact differently. So they have different chemical modes in different proteins. So that's why some a priori would be dangerous.
So if you have, say, 10 different signaling pathways,
yes,
or some 10 different pairs in one organism, and you're presuming that they function in the same way and they have very similar structures, right?
Yeah.
And yet you don't want them to have crosstalk, so there's selection pressure to make them diverge from one another, at least in the key. There must be key things which are definitely divergent from one another.
Mm.
So what's keeping them the same is my question.
Right? So
why does the structure need to be conserved at all?
So we see that many of these sites which we find are involved in this interaction are sites which have a very high entropy as a single site, whereas others are much more conserved.
There's divergent selection pressures making these different pairs of proteins want to be different.
And then they are different in the, for instance, in the positions which are the ones which are responsible.
Why are they completely different? Why are they all working by the same mechanism?
Just works nicely, the mechanism. But probably they, in some cases you see that they really go back to some duplication divergence event.
So Ranganathan found the answer to this question, right? One of the claims they make is that there are different parts of protein that are evolving independently of each other. There's a part that is a scaffolding, which is for structure. And then there's a part which is functional, which is more specific. So you could imagine the scaffolding remaining the same, whereas the functional part is diverging.
But even in the scaffolding, let's say in the structure from the homodimer case, we see that also inside the structure we have these covariants. So that even there, that where inside the protein you would have no a priori, no selective pressure for diversity, and still there it works. So we don't.
But what they claim is that it's not just single amino acids that are being retained. It's some kind of functional correlation between structures, multiple amino acids within the structure that is co-evolving, which keeps the function the same. Which keeps
you mean that basically this would be factorized over groups of amino acids, which some of them are involved in, I don't know, the structure of the thing itself. Some are involved in, for instance, in the for the response regulator in recognizing the kinase others and the homodimer.
That's the thing.
Actually, it's quite interesting if you look to the homodimer analysis, so just response regulators, you find some strange signal which looks like a false positive in distance of the homodimer, but which are exactly the sites which are interacting with the kinase. So even without knowing the kinase, you somehow find a signal which says that something is going on this helix.
Within one protein.
Within one protein, yeah. So they are not among the highest. So they are not. They are the first one of this type is appearing at rank 20, 25. I don't remember exactly the number, but they still appear in between those which are have good, which we were quite astonished about.
Thank you.